This is a continuation of an interview with Geoffrey Bingham, who's speaking with me, Rob Lynn, for the Oral History Collection of the National Library of Australia. Geoff, again, on behalf of the Director General of the Library, I thank you for agreeing to be interviewed. Do you understand that the Library owns copyright in the interview material, but disclosure will be subject to any disclosure restrictions you impose completing the form of consent?
Yes, I understand that.
This being so, may we have your permission to again make a transcript of this recording should the Library decide to do so?
Of course.
And again, we hope you will speak as frankly as possible, knowing that neither the tapes nor any transcripts produced from them will be released without your authority. This interview is taking place on the 24th of May 2005 at Kingswood, South Australia. Geoff, in our last talk a week ago, we journeyed with you to Malaya.
That's right.
With the truth. And yes, you arrived. Now, could you give me an overview of what happened in Malaya in terms of the campaign and your part in it?
Yes, well, we went up to a place called Seremban and Port Dickson, which were on the west coast of Malay Peninsula. But others of the Australian troops went on to Kuala Lumpur and even north of that. And so what we were doing was jungle training. And of course, we were not at war with Japan at the time. And so we were getting prepared for when we did meet them. And we had what was proper jungle training. You don't do that in Australia by nature of the case. And in doing that, we went up and down the peninsula, like, for instance, when we ran in motorcycles. In those days, you used to have to run in an engine, so we'd have to do so many hundreds of miles up and down the peninsula, and that was a bit of a fun time as well. But also we went into the jungle, and we did trips down rivers on rafts that we made, and it was pretty constant, and I think we were pretty, by the time the Japanese came, we were in top pitch as far as being a fighting force was concerned. After a period of time, we moved from north west down to southeast, which was a place called, for us, was a place called Mersing, but of course all the other troops in our division were in that area. Our headquarters was still at Kuala Lumpur, but the different units, the infantry and artillery units, and the units that go with them, like ASC, the Serving Corps. All of those units were, you know, there's a functional formation in divisions and corps and brigades and battalions. So we were occupied in all of that. I was asked at one stage to bring out a journal for the 22nd Brigade, and we were located at 22nd Brigade headquarters, and our job was to give communication to the battalion headquarters. And it was called On Guard, which I did, and that gave me a little bit of opportunity to move around Malaya a bit in order to get ads and help. And then afterwards, the CEO of our unit wanted me to bring out one which we call signals, I think it was something, signals, and that was the second journal I brought out in that time. For the rest, it was just straight heavy training. And at Mersing, where we were anticipating Japanese would arrive on the coast there. The English understanding of the way the Japanese would work is that they would come by navy vessels, and that they would start at Singapore, and as you know, we had the great big guns that pointed out to sea. And as you know, they didn't come through Singapore, they came through Thailand. And so we met them in the north of of the peninsula, particularly the headquarters units, so that war began.
Yeah. Jeff, with the writing you were doing in the journals, was that an extension of something you'd been doing in Australia as well?
Yes and no. We had a boys' club which was very highly organised, very functional, and I used to run out a magazine every so often for them, and I can't say that my writing was with the intent of getting stories published mainly. I know when we went down the river, the Kennebore and Trying Rivers in Malaya, it was a pretty big project which took about 24 hours, that's fine. I wrote a couple of articles on that trip down and sent them to the ABC, and they were read over the ABC. That was my first contact with the ABC. I had plenty when I came back. Plenty. They used to read my stories.
So that's just part of the literary evolution.
Yes. But I wrote a lot, which of course I didn't publish or didn't have the opportunity to.
Was that poetry as well as narrative?
Yes. Well, it's curious that the poems that I wrote were put in these two journals. They're still easily available, and there's one called Song of the Signals, and that has become a kind of a classic. It's often published in different magazines. Very interesting.
Jeff, had your battalion expected the Japanese to come down through Thailand?
I think all the Australian, the Australian mind, there was a big, there was a sort of, I'm just at a loss for the moment to think of the word, but it was a tactical exercise of all the British Commonwealth troops, when I say all of them, selection, in 1939, and the English insisted that the British were coming, that the Japanese were coming through Singapore, and the Australians insisted that they would come down through Thailand, and the Australians were right in the long run. The British mind wouldn't shift from that idea. We of course were all part of the whole of the trip, so something like upwards to there were 90,000 troops taken in Singapore, and so you had British, we all call ourselves British anyway, but you had a lot of Indian troops and other troops.
Dutch?
No, they were all empire troops there, none others, and there was a Malay regiment, and the Malays themselves didn't love the British all that much, and of course they cooperated with the Japanese at certain phases, and which has been denied, but I think it's correct. So that was the trip. We just had to go according to the English mind, because they had a great proportion of the troops, and our higher officers consulted with them. But the plus from that exercise that they had in 39, they acted upon that as their strategy. And I think if they'd had more of the Australian mind to begin with and been prepared that way, where we were on the coast of Mersing, the south east coast of Mersing, our Brigadier Taylor, he had planned to build something like the thing at Tobruk, sort of a fortress, to make a fortress of it, and he worked, and we all worked in that, particularly our part in signals and setting up signal communications. Very, very fine work it was, and we were all disappointed that we had to withdraw to Singapore Island, because we reckoned the way we had sort of set out the fortress principle and the food of the stocks and water and all that, was we were going to be able to last out a long time. But of course, as you know, the things turned out differently.
But Jeff, a couple of the paintings of Murray Griffin's that I've seen in the War Memorial.
Yes.
One of them depicts you up a signal, well, a telegraph pole, effectively, adjusting wires.
Yes.
But the whole look of what you're on about with the signals in that painting, at least, is quite primitive. It was, if you like, makeshift for the time, and obviously almost there's a feeling of hurry about getting this done. How did you feel there on the ground? Was it that primitive?
I don't think it was primitive at all. Mm. As to, you know, to signal techniques, we were right at the top. I mean, it was there that we first experienced scrambling messages.
Mm.
That had not been done before. And yes, we had all the equipment, which was very good signal equipment, and I think we were very well trained in it. But that scene that you see is, we were most seeing, which was on the coast, but there was a 26 mile road to a place called Jemalawang, which was further up the coast. And in that particular case, when the Japanese planes came, the Zeros, they would, if they saw just one human being, if they caught sight of one human being, they'd drop a bomb, not just go and strafe him, but drop a bomb. And so they just had so much massive of war equipment. And in that particular case, these Zeros were they carried a single bomb or something like that. But they would go down strafing the road. So we signals in our trucks, we were trying to keep the communications open, and instead of laying line for 26 miles, we used the road lines, like what we would call the PMG lines, yeah, in Australia, and we couldn't get through. That they'd bomb this, they'd bomb that, and strafe this and that. So the point where I was up the pole on the ladder, and I told all the fellas, because of the strafing that was going on, I said, you go into the jungle, because they see us as a group where we have it. So I went up the pole and joined up the lines, which gave the brigade headquarters communication with the battalion that was at Jemalawang. And I'm sorry, not Jemalawang, Endau, E-N-D-A-U, yes, from Mersing to Endau was 26 miles, so Jemalawang was going a little bit north again in the centre of the peninsula.
Jeff, was it about that time that you received your injury and also won the military medal?
No.
Was that later?
That was much later. That was on Singapore Island.
Singapore Island itself?
Yes, yes.
In the retreat, if you like, back to Singapore.
But they did recommend me for decoration for what I'd done there, and that eventually came out as a mention of dispatch. And there's a quite a story about that, but that's not to be told. Yeah.
But the story, though, about how you had your legs shot up.
Oh, yes. Well, we all withdrew. They called it strategic withdrawal, but we all withdrew. All the troops withdrew, and that was very well planned, because instead of having an enormous group of different units coming together and being unable to, you know, just the road logistics and so on wouldn't have prevented that. And so it was very well done. And when the last troops had gone over the causeway from Johor Bahru to the island,
mm-hmm.
And the Scotties, the Black Watch, those men, they skirled their way across, and then part of that was blown up, part of the
the bridge, the pontoon bridge.
Yes, it wasn't a pontoon bridge. No, it was a.
A ferry?
No, you went right across.
I thought you did. This is across the straits.
Yes, yeah. Chase of Johor, yes. Yes, they withdrew, and then they blew up part of that as the last thing. But I think then we had the whole position of Singapore Island, that's been often told, and but we'd had no Air Force, whatever, that the few Air Force planes we had at the beginning, they were quickly shot down. So we could never meet them in the sky. Although we found later that there were crates of British planes there on the wharves, but they were never assembled. And that was all that business about Churchill not wanting to give equipment to us because it was going to be lost or whatever. It's sort of a bit hard-headed as far as the troops are concerned, but at the same time all the oil wells, the storage tanks, they were bombed, and it was just black smoke right across Singapore Island. Everybody was blackened in their clothes and in their face, and you'd just see the whites of the eyes, you know, when a man's eyes were open against the background of the black oil smut. And there were two sets of people. There were Singaporeans, the people who lived there on the island, one going north and the other one going south, and they were going to, like, one was going north, one was going south, but they were parallel on this main road, and so they didn't know where they were going to go and couldn't do anything about it. But the area where we were, we had 2 or 3 days respite when we got onto the island and set up our positions, and the Australians had a very strategic front to the Johor Strait, and so we had to face the impact of their first landing, and they just came in innumerable rafts, one after the other, barges really, and they themselves, they were just, it was like a massacre. Our machine gunners just mowed them down and mowed them, but they still came on, and I know in our sector where we were, the Japanese had a little compass on their wrists, every one of them, and it was set on a village called Armaking, and they just came on, and the thousands of them were just spilled into the straits, or were killed, but the numbers were ultimately overwhelming. But then they were trying to progress towards Singapore, and we had to try to stem them. We were on the western side of the island, toward northwest of the island, on the island, and then there's a big story there. But anyway, it was in that I had to I led a bayonet charge at one particular machine gun nest that was doing a lot of damage, and that they got me in the leg, and I crashed over and had a massive blowout of the thigh and compound fracture of the femur, and that was that. Yes, I did. Just previous to that, I had been ferrying the brigadier around on the back of a cycle, because you couldn't use trucks there. There were so many bomb holes and shell holes. They fired a quarter of a million shells at our sector in 24 hours. Quarter of a million in 24 hours, just on the Australian sector. I mean, they've fired them elsewhere too, but it was a mess. And so the brigadier got on the back of my motorcycle, and he went out to look at all the positions and so on. And he wasn't on the back of my cycle when this happened. It was late one night, and a road called Reformatory Road, and we were there. And there was a big dam, and ducks on the dam, and the ducks didn't take any notice of us. But when the Japanese came, they set up a great commotion. We really knew the Japanese were coming. Very interesting point that. And then I can remember there was a 43rd Brigade, a British British something number, you know, 43rd Brigade, and I remember the brigadier came up to me, and I was only a sergeant, and he saw my stripes, and he said, "Sergeant, what are we going to do? They're these men that I've got here, they won't fight." And they were a sick regiment, S-I-K-H, of course. And so he said, "What am I going to do?" And that's how it was, that people got to states just sort of hopeless. And who was I, a sergeant, to give the brigadier a help? And I just said to the six who were standing there, "You're cowards." Well, that was a very stupid thing to say, because it's often said of Indians that if they're winning, they are fierce and deadly, but if they're losing, they aren't. Well, I suppose that's true of most dispositions. And anyway, one of them had a fixed pain on his rifle, and he went for my stomach with an officer, knocked his rifle up and said, "Stop that," and that was saved my life. And then just a few minutes later, when the machine guns began around our brigade headquarters, I said, "Who's coming?" And so I led this charge, but at the same time, I can remember the brigade major, I don't know if we were parallel or not, but we were all charging up anyway at the machine gun, and that's when I was hit and my leg smashed. But actually we did drive the Japanese back, and the brigade headquarters in that sense was saved, and that was what I was given a military medal for that.
Were you evacuated to Singapore after that? After your wounding? To a hospital?
Oh, I was taken to a place called Gilmore Barracks, which was an English army barracks, but it had been made into a makeshift hospital. It was very good, really. Beautiful buildings and things, and yes, I was there for some days. And matter of fact, the Japanese came into our hospital and came into our ward. It was an officer, and he came to me and he said, "Are you English?" I said, "No, I'm Australian." He said, "Well, you shouldn't be fighting us." He said, "You helped us in our big earthquake of 1924. He said, "The Australia was wonderful the way they helped. You shouldn't be in that." Anyway, we were all wanting water, and so I asked him for some water, and ultimately he brought that. But he was, the troops that came in were the Emperor's Guard, Hirohito's...
the Palace Guard, weren't they?
Palace Guard,
that's
yeah,
right.
Yes, and they were very gracious, very, you know, sort of very warm and helpful. But just a few hundred yards away, and I think it's Princess Alexandra Hospital or Queen Alexandra Hospital, everybody was massacred. Patients, doctors, nurses, everybody. And some did eventually escape, but just a handful. They came in and they bayoneted patients on the operating table and the doctors, and one doctor was bayoneted and he fell and pushed an orderly under him as he went down, and he said, "Don't move, and they'll think you're dead." And that was very wonderful, sort of a parable of being saved by the blood, if you can put it that way. So amazing things happened in that place and in ours, and then we were taken from there into Singapore City. And there's a bit padding, like a big playing area in front of the GPO, and next to the GPO was a building, a Fullerton building. And was there they put us, it was very, very hard there, but in an amazing way we were able to have all kinds of Christmas parcels that were sent it took them from the PMG next door, and so we lived like lords on as far as food was concerned. The other wasn't all that marvellous. I was one of nine who were put into one ward, and our legs had broken limbs, and so I was put in an extension. I lay for a day or two before anybody even noticed me. I was just on the concrete floor with having had this dreadful bad leg. And anyway, we were put there, and then the Japanese came and said they wanted the whole building. It was strategically necessary, and the medical office tried to argue them out of it, but they were not going to be argued out. And as a matter of fact, one British officer became so angry that he slapped the Japanese officer, and it was touch and go whether he'd been executed there and then, but they didn't. And then we were, something was happening to us, and we would be taken out to a thing called Roberts Barracks, which was part of Changi, and by truck, and the officers had said to the Japanese, these nine men here, if we begin to move them, they'll die. And they said, well, we can't really be concerned about it, there's a war on. And anyway, I noticed that we were given very good lots of morphia and so on. And a year later, I met the ward sergeant. He didn't know that I was one of the patients, and he said, oh, the poor guys, he said they were going to die before they got to the camp, so we filled them up with morphia just to help them to die. And I can remember the nurses coming in, British nurses, and giving us shots every so often, and we were in a wonderful state, you know, with being actually, that's where I became an addict, I think, at one stage. And we were, so I said to the sergeant a year later when he was talking to me, what happened to the men? He said, well, there were two Aussies. I don't know what happened to them. He said, but the seven Tommies, British, he said, they died before they got to camp, as we had thought would happen. I said, well, I was one of the two Aussies, I said. And I said, the other Aussie, we both didn't die. I said, here we are. And he was mortified. I think he had told me the story. Don't you ever tell anybody that story, he said. Yeah, the things that happen in the midst. Yes, so then we were in prison camp then.
So, Jeff, what were your first impressions of the Changi situation?
Oh, well, what had troubled and worried me very, very deeply was that, you've got to say that the troops, many of the troops just panicked, and there was a dreadful cry, every man for himself. You know, the genius of an army is that you stick together and you're one great weapon against the enemy. But when people would panic, and then these cries would go up, the thing is too bad, every man for himself. And that carried on in many ways, and as you know, there are many accounts of those days, but I had been thinking my way through a lot of things during our war days, and particularly on the matter of mutual security, I suppose. The nations practice that on a world scale, and we should practice that on a unit scale and an army scale. And it was beginning to come to me that no human being was to be trusted under pressure, that people would give way ultimately under pressure. They might sustain themselves and their ethics, but let the pressures get worse and everybody would collapse. And it began to give me a horrible view and understanding of human beings, and the things that happened at the wharves where soldiers got their way onto ships by using their fixed bayonets. I mean, they didn't use them, but they bluffed their way on or pushed their way on, and women and children were in some cases left on the wharves, and all those terrible things. And when it came to food, you could see the beginnings of something very dreadful about food. And so I was just glad to be. They first of all took us to Selarang Barracks, which Selarang Barracks was really Changi. Changi prison camp, but not Changi prison. None of our troops went into Changi prison until we'd been there 2 years. It was for civilians who were incarcerated, and civilians only were in that, and and after 2 years, because the Japanese knew something was happening towards the close of the war, they put the men into Changi prison, because it was a high security place, and they wouldn't be able to do anything. And so after 2 years they developed a convalescent camp at a place called Kranji, and then I had to go out there. But my first impressions were frightening, because they were all wounded, and some men had one or two or three limbs, some had the top of their heads open, you could see their brain, I know one man had three limbs, he had lost three limbs, and all, it was frightening. And at night time it was just like bedlam, really, the screaming and the pain and the crying out, and people crying out, some of the soldiers crying out, "Mummy, mummy, mummy," you know, it was unbelievable. I never ever heard one cry out, "Daddy." I began to develop all kinds of theories how the way my mind works, but the food was just claggy rice. The cooks didn't know how to cook it at that time, well, they soon learned, but I didn't. There were loads of people who had dysentery, bacillary dysentery, which is very, very, very painful, and some of them just died because they want to die. On the whole, the troops thought it was unbelievable that the Japanese, and they thought these little yellow fellows and so on, should defeat the great British army. I mean, you wouldn't know the sort of approach and idea in the age in which we live, with all its political correctness. You'd be shocked at the mind of the troops, not only the British troops, but the Australian troops. And so a lot of them just gave up and died. They decided to die, and they died. It wasn't that they got special attention if they were in bacillary dysentery, things like tomato soup out of cans, and we thought that, I used to watch them not eating it, just left it there at the side of their beds and died, and I'd have given anything to have had a plate of tomato soup. I hated rice and so on. But gradually things got into order, and I think that our own leaders were very good in the way they handled the prison camp, because the Japanese did not want to have anything to do internally in the prison camps. They had catwalks around the prison camp where the guards would walk. About our own, we had our own doctors, and of course they were not fools in the days. I think it was maybe 2 to 3 weeks the Japanese didn't really regiment us. They were too busy trying to cope with what they'd never dreamed, the victory they would have and the thousands that they would now have to cater for, both civilians and army personnel. And so a lot of the troops just lay around in Singapore and in these beautiful homes that had been vacated, and they were able to pick up books that the expatriate population in Singapore was a fairly intelligent one, so there were good books to get, and they would bring those back, and others just loaded up all kinds of things and trucks and brought them into the prison camp, particularly food. And so, yes, so far as that was concerned, we soon got into fairly good shape.
Jeff, though, as the war dragged on, it became a time of great deprivation and hunger and starvation within the camp.
Yeah.
I know from reading your stories that there was a moment in which all the horror of what you saw changed for you, and you began meeting with a group that had an enormous effect.
Oh, that was after 2 years. After 2 years, and I had, in a lot of my writings, I speak about my disillusionment with human beings. And
were you angry, Jeff?
very angry, yes. And I was very angry because I used to go to the chaplains and say, well, see, I've been brought up really as a Calvinist in the theology, and I knew the doctrine of the depravity of man. But it's one thing to know that, you know, when you're in a comfortable land and it's almost mythical to you, but to see it happen, every man for himself was the cry that was there in the camp. Yes, and one of my friends came to see me, and I had lost 5.5 stone in 6 weeks, 5.5 stone, and I was, you could see my backbone through my stomach had collapsed, and you know, it was just flat, and you could see the bone through the collapsed body, and I was so skinny I could put my finger and my, you know, your long, tallest finger and your thumb around my thigh. And of course the place just stank horribly, what they call the surgical smell. And a friend came to see me, and he told me the story that some of the troops had broken into the hospital store and stolen drugs, had stolen drugs, and had stolen supplies of food, that were canned food, and I couldn't believe it. And then I was shocked beyond measure. But of course, I had to go through a lot of thinking and a lot of realizing of things, I was a person I would think of high ethical integrity, and I always had been, maybe even ultra sensitive on the ethical side. And so I began to get very angry and scornful, and I talked to the chaplains, and no chaplain was really able to give me much comfort or much understanding, because they faced this for themselves for the first time. And our society is back at home. Well, we're even in the Depression, people would help people, but this was different altogether. If a man was very ill and he was dying, they would watch in order to get his meal, which he might die while he's, you know, before he ate his meal, and they'd go for the meal, and things like that, which would shock us today. And some of that is, you know, you've heard in my books, and particularly Love is the Spur. And I went through a period which was very, very painful. And a few of our chaplains, not all of them by any means, they were generally very good men, but a few of them had got in on the rackets and the black market and all of those things, which were very primitive and in many cases quite evil. Eventually I had to work my way through that, and I was in my bed from when I'd been wounded on the 11th of February to May, and I'd had all my legs and my right leg in extension and all sorts of things that you do like that. And eventually I gradually learned to, very gradually, slowly learned to walk when the leg knitted, and then they asked me to be librarian to the camp, which I was, and that was a great thing for me. But of course we starved. No one could ever say there was one meal I had, I remember this one meal and it satisfied. Nothing ever satisfied because of the rackets that went on. They went on, I reckon, at the Japanese level. They were supposed to give us so many grams of food, and I reckon they took their, many of them took their thing. And then when it came to those who were cooking, and you can't just bundle everybody into that critical category, but it was there all the time, and people would lose their dignity. If you've read a book like King Rat or The Naked Island, you'll read all about that. And then, of course, when some of the troops said they went. I mean, it was difficult for us who were in Changi, but in a sense, it was, by comparison, it was like a picnic for those who went up onto the Burma Thailand Railway. Things were very, very dreadful there. And so, yes, well, it took me nearly 2 years to come to terms and to understand that how could I be critical of other human beings when I'm a human being myself. And given the dreadful pressure that would come to join the mob and every man for himself, and therefore he put you into competition with everybody else, and you no longer looked upon humanity as in a delighted way. I came to that in a crisis, which I've written about it two or three times, and the crisis really was that there was one thing I could do which would just slightly advantage me, but in principle any advantage you could obtain would be very cheering. You think, well, you know, I've got hope to live. Nobody wanted to die then. The early time, it was a time of despair and pain and so on, and many of them died, but every man fought and to live. And then that brought us into conflict and competition with each other. It's a very difficult thing in an interview like this to explain that, so I just recommend, say, getting the book as a spur, not as a commercial, but as that you go through that.
Yeah.
And even friends who've known me over many, many years said that they never realised, even though I'd explained the matter, that it's not every man for himself, but every man for everyone else, that we have to be other person-centred, not self-centred. And that all sounds like foolish idealism when you're in the business that, you know, you might have very long to live, and if you could get some advantage over another, that you would do that. But anyway, that what happened there strengthened the faith that I had underneath it all, and I saw had a whole new view of God and of man, and how one should be humble enough not to be critical of those who do things that are wrong and ethically out of case, and one should say, well, and what came to me was that I was being hypocritical in the sense that I was self-righteous about what I hadn't done, and probably about the good things that I thought I'd done, and say, well, I'm just the same flesh and blood as every other human being, and not to be judgmental. And I came to see the love of God in His, you know, in His Son coming into the human fracas and doing only that only which could transform men and women, save them and transform them. And that's when we began this group of, a number of us got together, and we decided not to go the legalistic way, and not to go the ecclesiastical way. For instance, if we read the scriptures, which we did every night, we would think in terms of our own situation. And I put it to you, Rob, that if you were to try to learn from the Sermon on the Mount, which says, take no thought for the morrow what you shall eat or what you shall drink or wherewithal you shall be clothed, and to know that there's nothing we could do to extend the food and the clothing and so on, and seemed to be impossible that those words wouldn't work in a prison camp. And we discovered by sheer experimentation that they did, and I couldn't explain that to you, it would be too difficult to detail it, but something grew up. And anyone who has read Miracle at the River Kwai, and I would recommend every human being to read that, Miracle at the River Kwai, and then contrasted with King Rat or the Naked Island, which was full of cynicism and you know, harsh despair, that God is, it is His world, and He's not absent from prison camps. God had to be in prison camp. And so it became very, very wonderful. Things had changed so much, and there were all kind of things I could recount about. Like, for instance, a bunch of fellows that didn't come as a bunch, but singly, were sent from Changi prison out to the convalescent camp. Some of them who were, actually they asked me if I could deal with them because they were supposedly homosexual. And now, physically, sexuality was hardly ever thought of. You were so weak, and you'd have to be in very good health to even have a sexual thought, and you'd never have a sexual action, just because of the sheer skinniness and weakness that we had. But as I talked to these guys and they came in, one by one, some of them came, and they came to know the power of God very real ways. And I, as you know, I've read some of the visions that some of them had too. It's quite amazing. But we used to have between 30 and 40 guys would come together every night, and we would go to an X-ray room, which was blacked out. The Japanese wouldn't allow us to meet together. Two people together would be enough. But anyway, they never did get in. If they had, we'd been in trouble. But we met, and it was just wonderful. And scriptures became alive in our situation. I remember once an East Berlin German who said that we didn't know what Christianity was till we were persecuted for it. It was built for persecution. And you've got to be in the dreadful situations to comprehend them.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, while I don't want to skate over the prison camp experience, I think your writings have detailed many of the things that it would be better for people to actually read that.
That's right.
I'm more concerned now in wanting to know what happened after your return to Australia. Yeah. How did what you'd been through relate to what you found when you returned?
Yes, well, when we returned, of course, it was just so wonderful, we couldn't describe it. And it was just so beautiful. And we were given such a marvellous welcome. And we were the first prisoners of war from Malaya who returned. I think the first of all of the 8th Division. And Sydney just turned out, and so did Darwin first, but then Sydney, of course, where we lived. And that was something that one never forget. And the crowds, masses of people, and the ticket tape, and all the wonderful things, and how we were taken in ambulances, but they left the back open so people could see us and we could see them. And then three beautiful young ladies got into my ambulance, and I thought they were very, very beautiful, and they start to kiss me and do all kinds of things, and I was a little bit scandalised, but not too much. Especially when I found out they were my sisters. They had changed so much in the years we'd been away. We were away for four and a half years, and they were just sort of mid-teens or late teens. And they were, yes, it was very beautiful. And come home to my parents and find that my father, who wasn't, like as I've explained in an interview before, that he was fairly anti-Christian things and so on. And but he just showed me that when we got home to Box Hill, you know, that lovely property, he showed me all the things he'd put in a wardrobe just especially for men where they were, and one of them was a little thing called what do they call them? It was a text box. It was
with promises.
Yeah, yes, precious promises, and each promise is in a little scroll, and you have a little pair of pincers and you pull it out from this mass of them, and my father said, "Let's see what we read one of these every day." I couldn't believe my dad would do that, you know, and he got one out and read it very piously and so on. And it came back to my mind a story that where the couple used to use this, you know, and the box dropped and all the promises all came out at once. And they're all for us, you know, all at once. But anyway, that was very loving. And the whole family were very affectionate. Some were still in the war, or not there to greet me. But I can remember that night as we had the meal, they'd let us come from the hospital the same day as we arrived back and go to our own homes for some day. And I can remember my dad taking me out and to feed the dogs. I had three dogs, a Kelpie and two Queensland Blue dogs, you know, they used on the farm. And he was throwing this food to them, and I couldn't believe what he was saying to them. You know, like, say, half loaf of bread and cake, and I'd been well fed on the ship home. That was a beautiful incident, you know, coming home. And I'd been fed very well, but I had to pull myself back from getting down with the dogs because see that good food, you know.
Mm.
And that was a bit of a shock to me, and I can remember that night going over to where, when I was working on the farm, every night I'd go to this, you know, put the cows in the night paddock, and then I'd look out the sunset over in the west, and used to pray that God would one day let me go to all of those countries and preach the gospel and tell the truth and so on. So I just went over and stood there, but I thought there's something different, something I can't put my finger on, but it was made me feel very sorrowful when I should have been, you know, in one way I was overflowing with joy too. But from then on, I went to church. I'd applied to go back into college, at Moore College, and they actually accepted my request. But I began to see this thing which had troubled me in the camp about our depravity and our cruel competition as human beings, and different things happened that probably best not to say anything because they may direct somebody's mind to somebody I might have known or whatever. But I became so angry and disillusioned because I thought the church hasn't begun to understand the mind of people who are in the forces, things that Christians told me that they did just shocked me. You might say that I was hypersensitive in regard to ethical things, and that's probably true, but I wonder how hypersensitive you can be with, like, the truth is the truth, the law is the law, ethics are ethics, and certainly the way you approach them makes a difference between what you call sensibility and an understanding. For instance, as far as the men were concerned, the things that they had done in the camp, well, I remember once my very close friend, who's still alive, Ken Topless, and he was a physiotherapist, right? And he used to try to get my dead leg to come to life and with all kinds of things, which he couldn't. And then one day he said to me, "I think you must be about the most egotistical man, person I've ever met in my life, and that shocked me beyond measure. And for weeks I went around lacerated, really lacerated, and I eventually came to see what he meant. And I think what he meant was that I was so idealistic and wanted everything to be such and such, and that I wouldn't do things which were unethical, but that you get a kind of a spiritual, religious sort of pride in being you know, the sort of person you are. And of course that undoes it, because pride is as dreadful a thing as a human being can have. And that taught me a great lesson, and I think that humbled me a lot. So I still had that in my mind when I saw society, but I was just disappointed at that. Even in the army there were things that happened, but they're quite hilarious if I was to tell the story. One was where I had daily subsistence for about a month, and while I was away, and they're going to call me back to the hospital, and they called me back about a day after I went home, and I had this month's subsistence, and I had tried to give that back. I went to the pay office to give it back, and they couldn't believe me. But first of all, the ordinary man is private.
Yeah.
And he said, "No, we don't do that." He said, "I've never heard of that." And then he got the corporal, and then the corporal was baffled, and they got the sergeant. I know it sounds as though it's a concocted story, but it's true. And finally got the lieutenant, and he said, "Well," he said, "Sergeant, would you please go away?" He said, "We have no precedent for this." And I said, "Well, what do I do with the money? It doesn't belong to me." And that's what I've been arguing. And he said, "Well, don't, you do what you do. Do what you like with it, but don't give it here." And so I went off, and then there was a problem ethically in my vocation. I go back to theological college. By this time I decided I didn't want to go back to theological college, but I would at least do a course which would be helpful ultimately. So I... But the man who was interviewing me was very unsympathetic, and I said I'd like to do a university arts course rather than do theology, and he wouldn't let me do that. He said, that's what you were doing before you went to the army. You were a theological student. That's what you have to be now." And I said, "Oh," I couldn't believe my ears, and you know, I don't want to open that up now. But things like that embittered me, and all sorts of things. And I shouldn't have been embittered. I should have learned. Like gone by the things I've learned, is that if other people are unethical and do these things, that's their problem, not mine, and I shouldn't be proud that I am ethical. And so I was married. I married this young woman that I told you about at business coaching college,
Laurel Chapman.
Laurel Chapman, yes. And by that time she had grown into a very fine looking woman, and
she was the young lass who you told looked about 16 with all her hair down, and she was indeed 16.
Yes, she said, "I am 16, blushing. And so now, she came out to the repatriation hospital, and that was a big event on its own, but I was done. I told my father I wouldn't get married till I'd done my arts courses there, and my father didn't giggle normally, but it was the closest thing he'd ever come to was a giggle. He knew I wasn't going to last out very long, and by that time I was 27. And anyway, we got married, and we went up the North Coast, and then this thing that we talked about of community that had been so marvellous, so beautiful in the prison camp, particularly the guys that we all came together. There was very deep love between us, nothing to do with homosexuality whatever, and the guys could hardly bear to break up. A lot of them were, some of them were Englishmen and others, and in Australia we would be separated and so on. But anyway, I still clung on to the fact that I believe that God's purpose for human beings was to be a family, or to be the family, and to be a true community. And so we went to the North Coast, and my wife, Laurel, she understood all the things I was talking about, and that was one of the great things. She was a very down-to-earth, still is, of course, person. But we were both on a kind of a mission. And it was, I can say quite clearly, it was not ideology that I had recognized. Basically, every human being sort of has his price, but how he retains what he really is under pressure. And so we began, and I used to help the farmers and what they were doing, but we had ways and means of coming together as a community and up in the place where we were in the North Coast. And then my brother, who lived on the South Coast, asked us if we'd come and share with him and his own, he was doing dairy farming at the time, and so we came down, but the idea was that I wouldn't have to do work, if I could help with some of the equipment that we needed to buy, and which we went down, and then I realised that my time of going through all of these things had finished. I could see my way clear to go back into college. I think I had not given up all of those wonderful ideas, but rather they were confirmed. But by this time I'd become a very well-known writer. The first week we arrived home.
Jeff, can I just go to the next tape, and then I'd like to come back to the writing.